Well, welcome back, everybody. You know, the ancient philosopher Plato was known for saying, the young and the old are taught falsehoods. The person who dares to tell the truth is called at once a lunatic and a fool. My guest today is Mark Settle, the CIO truth teller of truth tellers, who never got the Plato memo. Mark is known for being a seven-time CIO and a three-time winner of the prestigious CIO 100 Award. He's also a two-time author with two great books I highly recommend. One is Truth from the Valley, a practical primer on IT management for the next decade. And the second book is Truth from the Trenches, a practical guide to the art of IT management. Both great books. This legend continues to write today. He's got other outlets. He writes articles for Forbes and other outlets. He's got an amazing newsletter called The Modern CIO, which I highly recommend. We'll talk about that here in a little bit later. So I want to just jump in and get started with Mark because, again, a true tech whisperer. Welcome to you. And, you know, one of your true superpowers is your ability to lead under pressure, Mark. And so, in fact, Freddie Karas, your former boss at Okta, observed the following. He says, Mark is an absolute pleasure to work with. His experience, expertise, energy, and character are second to none. He's a pro's pro and has seen so much over his illustrious career that nothing fazes him. And he takes every curveball in stride. So, Mark, let's jump in there. How did you handle these curveballs? What advice could you give CIOs and IT leaders on demonstrating confidence, staying calm in the storm, you know, when those curveballs are coming at you from all over the place? So, Mark, welcome. Jump in.
Well, I've had two developmental experiences that are relevant to that question. The first is at Visa. So I worked at Visa for about 3 years, and I had never worked in a company that had such, you know, large, complex, online, real-time systems as Visa maintains. And although I'm sure they're more resilient today than they were in my era, but, you know, they would go hiccup in the night, and we would have, you know, issues and operational problems. And one of the, gosh, almost like theologies that was always at play at Visa was to continually come back to two questions. What do we know and what don't we know? And, you know, separate, like, what do we really know about this problem for sure? Like, we absolutely. And then, like, what do we don't know? And then what do we have to work on to, you know, move that stuff into, like, the known side of things? And, you know, that's something that was inculcated in me. I didn't really think of it too much consciously. But then over the years, I ran across a Sherlock Holmes quote, which kind of relates to this. And so one of my favorite Sherlock Holmes quotes, Sherlock says that when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, has to be true. And we would sit in these meetings and go, it couldn't be that. Well, it couldn't be that. No, I couldn't. And then we'd eliminate like every other thing and we go, oh my God, it's almost like got to be that thing. So that's one. And the other developmental experience, and this took a long time for me to kind of reflect upon and realize, I'm a graduate of MIT. And I think at MIT, I learned something that I would call the joy of problem solving. So when I first got to MIT, I took a lot of courses in math and physics. And we weren't given homework assignments. We were given problem sets. We were told to go off, you know, with our problem sets and come back with the answer to certain kinds of either mathematical or, you know, physics, you know, kind of problems. And I've that's become kind of an intrinsic part of the way I think as well. You can actually see that manifested in some popular movies. If you've ever seen The Martian with Matt Damon, and he's stranded on the surface of Mars, and he's allegedly an MIT grad in the movie, he's constantly solving just like one problem after another. Like every day he gets up, it's like, what is the problem that I've got to solve today just to get to the next day? And the other movie that I would cite is that of Apollo 13. If you've ever seen Apollo 13, one of the characters is an actor's version of Gene Kranz. So Gene was in Mission Control when Apollo 13 went sideways. And there's this one scene in which Kranz comes into a group of engineers And he explains, hey, we put them into the lunar module. We've powered down everything that we can. They've only got so much oxygen. And, you know, this is what I know. This, you know, again, what do I know? What do I know? I know this is what's going to happen. Frankly, what's going to happen is they're going to die if we don't figure out something to do to get oxygen to these guys. And before he leaves the room, he looks at the engineers and he says, okay, guys, work the problem. And I'm like, that's just sit here, just do nothing, but get this thing resolved. So it's kind of those two things, I think, really kind of separating a lot of the emotion that can be associated with curveballs and try to get back to like, what do we really know about this thing that seems, you know, so intimidating? And then, you know, how can we kind of deconstruct this into a series of problems that we can kind of tackle one at a time? And that's held me in good stead for many years.
Yeah, that's amazing teaching, Mark, and kind of gives me some insights in terms of how the greats had this knack, seem to be able to look around the corner, right, and anticipate things coming. And you know, Freddie went on to say something else I thought was really interesting about you as Mark the leader and Mark the person. He said, even better, Mark doesn't let his treasure trove of experiences handicap his thirst to learn new things and his natural inclination to innovate. Rather, they complement each other wonderfully. So what a great observation from Freddie, and, you know, fighting those risks of getting maybe complacent, leveraging our experience and your humility. So maybe speak to that, how you kept that sharp edge all that time.
You know, I think I was privileged in the fact that I got to work as a CIO in 7 different publicly traded companies. And as a result of that, what I found over the course of my career is I would do a lot of pattern matching, right? So what I mean by that is I might walk into my next company and look at the way they were running the IT service desk and think, oh no, like this is, we can do better than this. Like I know immediately, like there's some things that we've got to fix here. And then there would be other places where I'd realize I don't have a good pattern to match to, right? So a good example of that is when I went to work for Arrow Electronics, you know, we bought electronic components from a variety of component manufacturers, and we sold them to contract manufacturers that were making electronic devices. So it was a distribution business. It was a B2B kind of a distribution business. And I think we had only like customers, we had maybe several thousand customers and then several tens of thousands of component manufacturers. And we sat in the middle, you know, of that whole kind of value chain. And it was a completely different sales process than I had ever really observed before, been part of before. And so my ideas about the right way to, you know, set up systems and support that sales process, really I had to get kind of reinvented from scratch. So that's, you know, I actually wonder if I'd stayed at one place for 20 consecutive years, for me, I think I would have gotten kind of stale. And I think it, you know, I would have gotten locked into certain ways of thinking. And I'm not saying that everybody that has a 20-year career in one place is guilty of that, but I think I would have suffered.
Well, 7-time CIO, you've seen a lot, you've done a lot. CIOs come to you when they've got hard problems. And in fact, I've got 4 amazing CIO friends of yours, all know you very well. I think they're all from the Valley, actually. And so they've provided a plethora of mystery questions that are going to help us really get to know you better and understand you better. So let's listen, and you know how this works. We'll listen to the first one, and you can tell us who this is.
Hey, I've got a question. Mark, from the time I first met you, has been talking about what he calls the precious gift of discretionary bandwidth, the thinking time that can really take a CIO from a back office leader to a strategic partner, if only they were to allocate time and spend it in a productive way. So I'd love for Mark to expound a bit more on thinking time and how that precious gift of discretionary bandwidth creates a superpower.
Who was that mystery questioner?
Oh, it was Ralph Lohr. I recognize Ralph, yeah.
He's one of the greats for sure.
That's actually a tough question, but I would contend, if you don't have an innate curiosity about how the business works, you're never really going to be effective CIO. I mean, you can manage the IT function effectively, but its ability to have an impact on the business, almost by definition, will be very, very marginal at the end of the day. And again, I think I'll go back to that pattern matching. point that I made a minute ago is you land someplace and you realize this is different than anything I've ever seen before. In fact, I'll share another story about Visa. And I hate to say this because it shows how young I was at one point in time. So I took the Visa job, and really going into the job, I said to myself, how hard can this be? You swipe the card and it gets approved and the banks settle up at night. Like, that's all that this thing does. Like, this must, you know, I understand the business. I said to myself, I completely understand the business model, how this is going to work. And, you know, it took me about 12 to 15 months to get a master's degree in credit card transactions to really understand what was going on, you know, under the surface. So I don't know. I think it was just, again, moving around from one place to another and being challenged to try to figure out how I could make an impact. And to do that, you know, I just had to kind of go out, be the anthropologist that Ralph's referring to, and stumble around and figure out what was going on.
I love it. I love it. I love the business strategy whisperer. That's fantastic. Well, Ralph, your friend Ralph had another great mystery question I wanted to bake in that's going to unpack more of your secret sauce. And, you know, Ralph and I did a podcast. Actually, we did a double back in 2023 when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, which was
great. Oh, yeah, great. He's a great guy. Yep.
Yeah, he is. So let's listen in on Mark's second mystery question from Ralph Laura.
You know, one of your superpowers has always been being the kind of business strategy whisperer, being able to put technology and business together and kind of make magic happen. You've used the term insatiable curiosity about how the business really works. I think that actually inspired my coining of the phrase, the Jane Goodall approach to IT. You don't go ask marketing what you want. You go observe marketing in the wild and then infer from that what their behavior is and what their needs are. And I think you're the master of that. I'd love for you to expound a bit more on kind of how you get inside the head of your business partners to create uncanny value.
So, you know, if you've got a good team with good direct reports, you really should not be spending a lot of time looking over their shoulders, trying to help them solve, you know, day-to-day problems, in effect, trying to do their job for them. I'm frankly not a fan of weekly or biweekly one-on-one meetings with my direct reports, because I think, you know, the monkey kind of jumps from their back to my back. Or if they fail to, you know, reach their objective or do what they need to do, the fact that they told me that they were worried about getting this thing done 4 weeks ago, suddenly, you know, it's like partly my responsibility, am I? Because you informed me about this, you know. Just informing me doesn't mean it's, you know, I'm partially responsible for getting this thing done. So, you really need to step back. Now, if you don't have the kind of people that you can delegate that responsibility to, that's a different problem, right? But presumably you've built a good team. You shouldn't be looking over their shoulder. And when you sit in a large enterprise, the CIO job, I hate to say this, but in a way it's kind of easy, because if you've put together the right team, all you have to do is establish priorities, obtain the resources for the team, and then manage the organizational politics, you know, kind of be on like a intelligence G2 gathering organization about how perceptions are changing about the IT function within the company. And I think you'll find that if you can restrict yourself to those kinds of things, you know, then you do have a fair amount of discretionary bandwidth. And, you know, that's a way to bring some objective reality into the organization. What I mean by that is, you know, if you go out and visit some other folks, maybe, you know, and benchmark some of your operations around what they're doing, or, you know, the AI phenomena that's occurring right now is the perfect example of that. So let's say I'm the CIO of some company and IT shops, you know, run pretty well. Man, I would be out, you know, pounding the pavement, finding out what kind of AI experiments and prototypes my peers are doing, what kind of initial use cases are producing, you know, measurable benefits, instead of me trying to wander off and invent all that stuff on myself, by myself. So I think, you know, that's what I mean by discretionary time, is figuring out ways the function can have a more strategic impact. And to do that, a lot of times you have to bring in learnings from outside the organization. I mean, that's an important part of your role. And, you know, if you're not careful, your own staff creates a black hole for your time and attention. They all want to, like, get you in a conference room and show you PowerPoint slides or schedule meetings or you know, show off some of the work that their people have done to position that individual for a promotion or a pay raise somewhere downstream. And if you're not careful, that's, you know, at the end of the day on Friday, you look back at your calendar and go, wait a minute, that's what I did this week. I just kind of pandered to the interests of everybody in the organization. I'm not sure I did anything that's going to have any strategic impact.
Yeah, I think you just gave us some great clues into how the great leaders maximize the return on their time. We all have 24 hours, right? And so what we do with it, what we get out of it matters. And you know, there's something else that you've done very consistently in your CIO, your seven-time CIO journey. And this next mystery questioner kind of speaks to how you prioritize relationships, how you're always helping others. So let's uncover another truth of Mark Suttle here with this next question. Tell us who this is.
I remember my first meeting with Mark Suttle like it was yesterday. It was at FAS in Mountain View, and he had proactively reached out to me shortly after becoming the CIO of Okta. And I was so impressed that a multi-time CIO would be reaching out to me, a first-time CIO. And he's just amazing at proactively building a network, connecting colleagues, connecting with himself, sharing thoughts and ideas. Just, Mark, tell us more about how you do this.
So that's Julie Colvin. And so let's wade into that question a little bit. You know, what I think you'll find over the course, well, I know you're going to find over the course of an IT career, is that you usually make your big initial impact based on your technical skills or technical experience, technical insider, you know, whatever. And as you progress, two things happen. So your technical skills atrophy. There are new things that come along that you just have never experienced firsthand. And so your, you know, intuition and insight becomes progressively limited, and your ability to contribute technically becomes limited. And, you know, in my personal experience, roles that I've risen to, you know, later in my career, are really far more based on my ability to work with other people and my business acumen or my business experience. The fact that I have seen these different kind of business models, you know, in practice. In fact, that's kind of a secret weapon in the interview process. And so, you know, when you're sitting there in the interviewee chair and you're asking them questions about like their SAP system or, you know, what kind of, you know, mobile strategy they have or whatever. I don't mean asking the candidate. I mean, I'm the candidate. I'm asking the company, let's have an IT conversation. I want to have an IT conversation with you about whatever. That's one kind of path you could take. The other path would be just what I said before about Arrow Electronics. Oh, at Arrow Electronics, this is the way we ran the sales process. Like we had this, like, you know, whatever. And looking into the way your company operates, I would think that this is sort of an analogy. And so, like, this is one of the problems we ran into. And so I'd really be curious to know how you're dealing with that over here. You know, that really wows them in the interview process. They think, wow, the business discussion. I thought this guy was going to come in and tell me that I needed to migrate from, you know, SAP to Oracle because that's his favorite system. So to summarize, you kind of, you move along in your career through the ability to work with other people and this kind of business knowledge and experience that you have. And so I would contend that if you really don't like working with people, and I don't, you know, I hate to say you're an introvert, but you just like, you know, your world very well defined, left in many cases to your own devices. You don't want a lot of disruption of other people offering their opinions or evaluations of your work, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's the way a lot of work gets done within a company. But I think you'd find it very difficult to be a successful CIO. So I think the answer to Julie's question is it's just kind of an innate, you know, source of pleasure to meet new people, learn from them, and, you know, just again, expand the network. I think, you know, networking, professional networking is a superpower of some of the most successful CIOs that you'll find. The fact they can pick up the phone and, you know, again, learn a lot from their colleagues.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great observation. And, you know, Julie's just one of my favorite people. Her last operational role, as you know, she was concurrently, she was the CTO and the chief people officer at the same time. So pretty special, great talent. She's gone to do board work. She's doing some executive coaching with us. And just making big impacts on people in many different ways. So thank you very much, Julie. And we've got another one for you here, Mark, another friend from the Valley who's going to build on Julie's question. So let's see if you recognize this voice.
Hi, Mark. You have been a seven-time very successful CIO. My question is, what is the one thing you would tell a CIO to do in the first 90 days of a new job?
So that's Carter. I recognize Carter's voice. And let's unpack that a little bit. So let's not talk about like a one thing, like the one thing that you have to do. I'm going to suggest several things. So the first is, you've really got to understand how the company is spending money on IT. Like, you really need to understand your budget. I don't just mean like at a cost category level, but, you know, how are labor costs divided up, maybe across the demographics of the team, use of contractors, offshore staff, et cetera. What are we spending money on in terms of vendors? Like, who are the big vendors? Are there some opportunities there to optimize costs in that time that renewals come up? You know, have we benchmarked? Have we taken some of our functions and gone to see, are we running our data center as efficiently as other people are able to run their data center, et cetera? So you need to be really conversant with the money path within the organization. And man, if you're conversant in that area, you know, you immediately have CFO credibility. You know, and I hate to use the term run IT as a business. I'm much more like the phrase run IT like my business. Like, let's say it was my money that was going, would I like not dig into some of this and figure out what's happening? So, you know, that's a square one kind of thing that you need to dig into immediately. You don't want to walk in and say, I don't need to worry about money in the middle of the fiscal year because I'm not going to have to justify anything until the next budgeting cycle comes around. Number two is pretty obvious, and we all talk about this, but you've got to work on relationships with the other executives. In fact, I'll tell you a funny story. When I went to BMC, there was an auditorium, small auditorium at corporate headquarters, and they introduced me as the new CIO, and they put me up on the stage. And you know, the whole IT crowd came in. So I introduced myself and talked about my background. And I said, well, like, are there any questions? And there was an awkward silence. And so this one guy stopped and said, kind of like what Carter's asking here. He said, like, well, now that you've come here and you've been here for a couple of weeks and, you know, you've gotten a chance to learn a little bit about our organization, like, what's your number one priority? And I said, without skipping a beat, I said, to get the other executives to like me. Okay. And the whole audience broke down in laughter. I mean, like, they thought that was the funniest thing. And I said, no, I'm serious. Because, you know, I told him, I said, things go wrong in IT all the time. And so if they don't like you, they can crucify you. You know, like, you need some measure of, like, goodwill to just exist in a job like this. And so, you know, those relationships are super important. That's kind of number two. Three is a little bit unorthodox. So I think you need to test your own leadership team. And I think if you've inherited a leadership team, whether they will tell you this or not, they're operating in kind of a wait and see mode, right? They're like, is this guy really the path to the promised land? Is he going to get me the budget and the extra staff? Is he going to finally bite the bullet on some of the, you know, things I wanted to get rid of, or people changes I want to make, or, you know, whatever. And so they sit in their comfort zone, and, you know, the apps leader says, I know more about the apps here than several of those. And the data center guy says, I know more about the data center than, you know, several of those. So the trick is to give them assignments that don't fit into the current scope of their responsibilities. So you tell the data center guy, I want you to take over the service desk for the next 90 days and give me like some recommendations where we can improve service levels by 30% at the desk. And I want you to step out of your current job. This is not in addition to your current job. This is important to me. I want you to do it. And you know, man or woman would say, well, I can do them both, boss. Like, I can do anything you want me to do, but I can't. So I said, well, you're telling me you don't have a lieutenant that you've groomed that could actually step up and run it for 90 days? I mean, you know, I'm not asking for like 2 years. I'm just saying for 90 days. And so testing your own team and getting them a little off balance is a good way to figure out whether you've got the right people or not. And then, you know, the other thing is you've got to make changes within that change window. And another experience I had, I was in a company, we had acquired another company, and the directive from the CEO was don't go into that other company and start making IT changes because there's certain financial targets they have to meet this year. Those were like the preconditions of the acquisition deal. And we said we'd be hands off for a year. Then we'd go in and start moving them onto our systems and whatever. So of course, human nature being what it is, at the time of the acquisition, all those people in the acquired company were kind of like emotionally off balance. And if we had come in and said, you know, we don't like the color of your system and we're going to move over to ours because we only run blue systems here, they'd say, wow, I think blue systems, that's what I always wanted to work on. I thought that would be fabulous if we could only have blue systems. But a year later, well, now it's a whole different conversation. Now it's a debate, you know, it's harder to make changes. And so don't fritter away your change window because, and particularly with regard to personnel actions, you know, I talked about knowing your budget as a credibility builder. The other way you can build some pretty instant credibility is by frankly shedding some people who have always been a thorn in the side, either of your own people in the function or in the side of the business. And it's so easy to go in and ask for more money for staff if you can show that you are aggressively managing performance in your own organization. I'm not just going to tolerate average or substandard performance, you know, and ask for more people. I'm going to kind of clean up the shop here. And you don't, I'm not talking about, you know, massive layoffs or anything, but, you know, you need to send the signal that that there's kind of a new sheriff in town, you know, and maybe like the way things worked around here are going to change. There's one other thing I'd add for your audience, which I haven't seen talked about much. And that is, I think if you show up from the outside, you're the new CIO and you've shown up from the outside, you tend to tell yourself, oh, I've got a clean slate. There's a blank sheet of paper, right? I'm going to come in here. They're going to form their judgments about me and how effective I am and, you know, how good I am at managing people, et cetera. That's not true. What is true is that each of those other executives has a mental model of what a CIO is. They've built that mental model, and you have to sort of break those molds and show them that you don't fit into the model that they had before. Like the person that always said, I always need more money, I always need more people, and they don't deal with the performance problems, they're resistant to change, they don't listen to feedback that's coming from the business, you know, they're the pointy-head tech guy that wants to build out a blockchain application for, you know, the service desk or something like that. So you kind of have the stigma. That's not a good term, but, you know, that's how our brains work, right? We try to like take new situations and classify them in some way. And that's how we all kind of survive mentally. And that's what happens when you come in as the new CIO. All those other execs, the CFO has his idea or her idea of like what a CIO does and is and the limits of their thinking and creativity and, you know, whatever else, and empathy, and same thing across the board. So don't think that you're just walking with a kind of this blank, you know, mental set of perceptions. Those perceptions in many cases are very well established, and you're going to find it hard to kind of break out of the mold that they want to put you in.
Yeah. So many good leadership nuggets, Mark. And Carter Buss, I really appreciate you and the trajectory at Workato and all the great work going on there. And I've got one more mystery questioner for you, Mark. So I want you to, this is going to be another fun one for you. And it's going to talk about some of your leader as teacher tendencies. So check this out.
I'll never forget the day I met you. I was a first-time rookie CIO 10 years ago, and I was incredibly inspired to meet an acclaimed 7-time CIO and 2-time author, Mark Settle. You graciously offered to share signed copies of your book, Truth from the Trenches, to my entire team. 4 years ago, you released your second book, Truth from the Valley. I'd love to know the name and target release date of your third book that we're all hoping for.
Well, I recognize Alvina's voice for sure. And this is a short answer. I don't know if there's going to be a third book. I continue to blog on a pretty regular basis, and anything that I do, I repost onto LinkedIn. So I suspect, well, I'm already a first level connection on LinkedIn with Alvina, so she can track that. But if you have other members of the audience that would be interested in kind of keeping up with my prognostications, I just suggest that they reach out and become a first level contact, and then they'll receive, you know, like notifications when stuff gets posted. But yeah, I don't know about that third book. I'm not so sure.
Well, you're doing a lot of writing, a lot of teaching other ways. And you've mentioned a couple times some of our language. People refer to politics, but it's usually in the negative. And I think many people in our profession wake up, jump out of bed and say, I can't wait to go engage in politics today. Can you give us a different mindset on that, how we should think about that and how you would see yourself positively and proactively engaging in organizational politics?
Let's go back to the golden rule that we chatted about a minute ago, which was, you know, if you really don't like interacting with people, you really shouldn't be in any management role, much less a CIO role. So like if you wake up in the morning and think, I know there's some dissatisfaction over in the customer success area, and I know the marketing people aren't happy, and I know the software engineers are less than pleased with, you know, things that the IT organization is doing to support them, you can think to yourself, well, if it'll just go away, like it's not like a crisis or anything, one, you know, or two, one of my members of my team will go and take care of that. That's not like my job. But that those misperceptions, if it is a misperception, those float up and those kind of fester, right? And so they can come back to roost 3 months later where you're looking for some support for something you want to do from one of those other kind of functions. And so the most important thing to do to not let those misconceptions fester is, first of all, you know, like, what do we know? What's the truth here? Maybe it's not a misconception. Maybe IT really screwed up. And guess what? You got to be a big boy or a big girl and go over there and ask for forgiveness, right? And say, like, you know, I'm acknowledging and we did this wrong, and here's the steps I've put in place so that we will never do this again. Like, I'm very cognizant of this. I'm on it. My eyeballs are on it. You know, we're going to work on this kind of thing. In many cases, the stories that have been floating around outside of IT are based on misinformation, right? So I remember this. I'll give you one example. I was in a company where CEO asked us to go do something quick and dirty up on the website for customers. And we all said, like, okay, boss, yeah, we'll go take care of that. So then we started to throw something kind of quick and dirty together, not our best, you know, most illustrious project. And then we took it over to another group and they said, well, if you're going to do this, if we're going to do it right, and they turned it into this big project. So the next time the CEO asked, where's that thing I wanted on the website? Everybody says, oh, IT dropped the ball. IT completely dropped the ball, like shows they can't get anything done in like less than 6 months. You know, it's their fault. And I'm thinking, no, it's this other function that Gabe said, well, if we're going to do this, like, here's the 100 requirements of like how we want it done. We didn't drop the ball. In fact, we were ready to do something quick and dirty. So you have to go kind of explain sometimes, here's the series of events. I'm not like, you know, pointing a finger at anybody, but this is how we got to where we are today. So do you want to overrule the person in your own organization that told us that we need to put in 100 steps, and we'll go back to the 10-step, you know, implementation of this idea, you know? Or do you want to go back to the CEO with me and explain, well, there was some misinformation in the organization here to float around, like, and we've locked our arms together and we're going to get our two teams to sort this kind of thing out. So, and those problems, like, they don't go away, right? Those are some of the hardest things you have to face up to. And I think some of the best advice that I've ever gotten my career is like, every day when you go in, you should work on the toughest problem first, probably the thing that you dread to do the most. The whole rest of the day is so much easier after you've gone and done that. It's otherwise you just like kill email, make some phone calls, you know, wander around with a coffee cup, chat with some people, and you keep like kicking the can down the road. And if then after lunch, you say, yeah, maybe tomorrow, I'll get around to that tomorrow. I'm not sure it's urgent that I need to take care of that today. But So I think that's the answer to the question is don't put off those kind of, whatever the problem is, could be, you know, an issue within your own organization that needs to be confronted in some fashion or another. And you know what? People really respect you for that. So you think, well, this is just kind of all negative for me. Like I have to go in and admit that we were wrong, or I have to tell some dirt about some other thing going on in the company. But as long as you do that consistently and with some, you know, integrity and you know, in a non-accusatory or non-blaming kind of way, I mean, people really, you know, like you said before, you become a truth teller. They think, well, he doesn't have an agenda. He's just telling me what the world looks like from his perspective and, you know, whether we have a problem that we need to collectively work on.
Well, definitely see the patterns here, Mark. You know, do the hard things, right? The change stuff, the hard conversations, the people stuff, the politics. A lot of this is covered in both your books, but in Truth from the Valley, your most recent book, it's subtitled A Practical Primer on IT Management for the Next Decade. You, if I remember, it was five levels of a CIO. I think it'd be really helpful. Could you kind of unpack those, what those are, Mark?
This is my personal journey. So I think, you know, when you become a CIO for the first time, you want to prove to yourself that you can do the job. And consequently, you frequently come across as like trying to be the smartest guy in the room, the smartest gal in the room. Then you try to prove to like your staff that you're worthy of managing them. So you kind of get into their business, right? And in both of those levels, you're really micromanaging, even though you don't recognize that you're doing it. You think you're helping, but what you're really doing is disempowering them. And you know, here's a good example. Let's say you had a bake-off between two vendors, and you get some preliminary feedback from the bake-off of what we've learned so far. And then you just make a gratuitous comment like, you know, the A guy looks pretty good, AMD. That A vendor looks, you know, pretty promising to me. I know we've got some other vendors, you know, that we're going to look at, or some other follow-on questions, and we need to make the reference calls and do all that other kind of stuff. And, you know, if you're chronically micromanaging, your subordinate is getting the subliminal message, oh, Mark's decided it's A. Like, I don't need to, like, put a lot more effort into this. Like, it's already a done deal. We're doing A. I kind of get that, okay? Just based on, you know, behaviors from the past. Then you graduate up to becoming the chief quality control officer. And what I mean by that is you say, oh, you know what? I can't get involved in every decision that's going on here, but I'm going to cherry pick the ones that I want to be in on. Okay. So be prepared. I'm coming to those meetings. Like, we're going to, like, you know, here's a great example. Let's say you did have an ERP system and you were going to upgrade it or add a new module. And earlier in your career, you were involved in an ERP implementation. You can convince yourself, I'm going into this meeting with the best of intentions to bring all of my knowledge and experience about ERP systems to help, you know, figure out a realistic plan for doing the upgrade, which is a good motivation. But again, the inadvertent effect is he knows how he wants it done. He's telling us how he wants it done. Why should we even look at, you know, he hasn't done an ERP upgrade in like 5 years. The world changed, you know, like this is different. But that's the message that you send. So you do that. And I'm kind of working my way up here. But I think at the top, you really have come to the realization that, you know, A, your technical skills have atrophied. You know, B, you've kind of got a good team in place, you know, and C, you know, you need to let them do it at the end of the day. You can expose them to information from other companies, you know, try to help them do the job better. But if you're actually sitting there saying to yourself, I don't trust my own team to be able to do these things, like really come to terms with that, then you got to go build a team. And if you haven't built the right team, you'll never get the discretionary bandwidth to have a strategic impact in the company. Because again, you're trying to like single-handedly run the IT function. And there's not enough hours in a day for anybody to actually do that, you know, when you've got 200 or more people in the function.
Those are great. I mean, that's a must-read book. And, you know, I'd love to have you, you know, we're all about helping our audience become those level 5 leaders, the enabler in chief. What are some of the keys to success in terms of getting there and more importantly, staying there, Mark?
You know, tackle those relationship and perception issues that are floating around, because they're going to come back to bite you. And work on sustaining those relationships with your business partners. I always tell CIOs that if you're not interacting in some fashion, then that'd be meetings. But if there's, maybe it's, you know, Slack messaging, or maybe it's emails, or maybe it's sharing information that you stumbled on that is relevant to some other area outside of IT, you know, whatever that is, however you work in a relationship. But if there's a big hiatus between the last time I went and talked to the CFO and the next time, or the chief people officer, or the next time, if you're not careful, you'll find yourself in a situation that when you do show up on their doorstep, you know, 8 times out of 10, you're there to either apologize for something that went wrong, or asking them to support your budget or some initiative that you're trying to launch. And it's like, you know, you can barely remember, you know, I'm talking, you probably don't remember my name. I'm Mark Settle, I'm the CIO. You remember, like I said, we haven't really, other than sitting in meetings together, we haven't really had any kind of a conversation in 5 months, but we corrupted the marketing database last night, and it's going to take 48 hours to rebuild it. And I'm having emergency meetings every 2 hours to make that work. You know, so yeah, so that's you want to avoid that, you know, at all possible costs. So the relationships, and you know, the other thing about relationships, I hope I haven't come across as suggesting that you want to do that as a defensive thing to avoid problems in the future. IT really can't do much can't be very strategic on its own. It ultimately has to partner with the business. I mean, you know, they're the ones, you can put in the best technology, but they have to use it, and they have to use it in the right way. And their senior management has to do more than say, yeah, I approve this shiny new toy. They have to go in and change the way people work, and maybe give them some new job titles, and, you know, reorganize them in some way that, you know, has a big impact on them. And I've been in too many initiatives where, when it comes time to get the money, the boss or leader of that function will stand up and say, I completely support this, and this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to order management. But then when push comes to shove at the end, there are people that say, well, I'm not going to do it that way, or I still want to, you know, do it the old way, or they just aren't willing to make the organizational and work process changes that are required to get optimum use out of the new technology. So you really, really, really need business partners, and more than just, you know, how we like to talk about in a Gartner context, alignment with the business or executive support. I've seen so many presentations where people say, no, the key to success for this initiative was executive support. Well, you know, like that's not a news story for all of us yet.
You made me think of an article you published on Forbes this summer. It was maybe speaks to this in a different way, but you talked about three simple truths when it comes to the elusive quest for workforce productivity gains. Do you remember that article? You write so much, I don't know if you remember it, but what are those truths? I think it kind of reinforces what you're just sharing.
So the first is, all the companies I've been with, and I think companies in general, it's really hard to establish productivity metrics. And people would say, no, that's not hard to do. Like if you make cars on assembly line, you know, like how many cars per hour come out the other end of the assembly line? Or if you're processing account payable payments that you're putting on a ledger or something, like how many ledger entries are we making every hour? And that's true. That can be done. But what will happen over time is business conditions will change. So you could have one assembly line that's turning out very complicated luxury cars, and there could be another production line that's turning out starter cars, you know, the low end of the model choice. And maybe like the entry-level cars are just a little fewer parts that you can make more of them, like per unit time, right, than the others. Or the processing the ledger payments, you know, if the business is growing, suddenly maybe you're sending out invoices with like 5,000 line items on the invoice, and those payments have got to get posted, et cetera, et cetera. And so suddenly you say, well, it seems to take so much longer to get like, you know, a payment posted to payables. Well, yeah, that's a good thing, probably. So my point being, forget about like cross company metrics, where you could say, well, there's one metric, right? Service desk rate. How many service desk tickets should a good service desk be able to close, like on any given hour or day or something like that? Well, it depends. And it depends a lot on the business and the workforce and geographic dispersion, et cetera, et cetera. So first truth, productivity metrics, it sounds like they should be easy, but they're really hard. And we're talking about people that like make things or do administrative tasks, which you can measure far more easily than knowledge workers who are like working on a marketing campaign or developing the new sales process or whatever. Like, what's the productivity metric that we want to apply to those kind of things? And those people in those jobs are non-exempt, and they're supposed to be able to set their own priorities and meet sort of, you know, generally defined objectives and not have time and motion studies done on what they're actually doing during the workday. Okay, so I'm belaboring this, but number one is that it's very difficult to identify productivity metrics. So what do we do instead? We justify, wow, lots of IT projects on the basis of time savings. So if we put the new tool in, we'll harvest these time savings, and voila, they will automatically turn into a productivity improvement. Okay. And one of the biggest fallacies of this is a scenario in which you give small slivers of time back to large numbers of people. A great example is, I'll go back to Arrow because it's ancient enough that I won't offend anybody at this point, I hope, at this point. But the head of the warehousing function, he could play IT like a fine violin. And that's because he had like lots of people in the warehouses that were constantly like either putting parts in or pulling parts out, to, you know, because we were the distributor. And he could manufacture IT business cases in which there were these tiny time savings that occurred across the entire labor force that was in the warehouses. And his like ROI would like beat the pants off of almost anything coming out of any other functional group within the company. He kind of could always justify when we should go out and do his thing. And of course, again, it's hard to harvest that time savings and direct it. And it's doubly hard for a non-exempt employee, right? Because you're not there looking over their shoulder, right? Saying, no, wow, you got 5 minutes back every third hour here on the job. So like, but now I want you to do something in addition. So that's number two, that we can't translate time savings, you know, into a productivity gain. And then I think the second simple rule is it's very, very difficult to attribute productivity gains of any type strictly to the introduction of new forms of IT technology. Because anything that's significant is probably going to involve changes in, you know, staffing levels, geographic, maybe we're going to move people around, as reorganize in some way, bring in new leadership. And my only point here is that when we bring in the technology, it's very rare that it's like a controlled experiment. Like, don't change anything about the business or the people or the organization before. You know, magic dust occurs. Now we've put in this new system. Now we look at like how everything works after the new system went in. That, in my experience, that's few and far between scenarios actually work like that. And so, like change of leadership, just a change of leadership alone might have far more of an impact on the quote unquote productivity of a team than some kind of a new tool that you've given them. Or, you know, if you said, well, let's see, we've got like this big centralized group and a high cost location. So when we bring in the new tool, we're going to actually stop operations there, divide them into three teams, put them into lower cost geographies in the US, and, you know, the tool will help us do that. And then we'll have this other org structure that we've had in the past. But you can imagine how disruptive that is. Like, I don't, you know, the before and after, to say, well, the tool is responsible for something that, for the delta that occurred in the after relative to the before, you're just like misleading yourself. And the other thing I'd be careful about, business leaders don't react well when IT people stand up and try to take credit for business value. Only the business people can can say, like, we got business value out of this. And, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Gartner, but like when Gartner says, well, you need to go back, right, and do like an after implementation business value analysis. Like, you promised in the business case, these things are going to occur, you know, and then afterwards you need to go document like that you actually delivered on this. And if you're the CIO and you say, oh, we put this in, we made this change, we upgraded this tool, and we went back and we found like the time savings and we found the throughput of the invoices increased and we got like a quarter of a car off the production line more every week, et cetera. Sometimes the results are so de minimis that they don't have any meaning to the business people at all. Or the business people sit there smugly and say, I don't want to get into a big debate here in front of the CEO, but I'm not buying this at all. Like, I don't think that had anything to do with, you know, getting those invoices through. So you just don't want to pretend like IT alone has somehow saved the company, for sure.
Good. More good truths here. One last question for you, Mark, before we pivot. You published a great article with our friend Martha Heller some time back about stop whining about shadow IT. It was great. It was just kind of like your style, your personality. I kind of want to fast forward a little bit, and people are talking today about shadow AI. So catch us up on what's the world according to Mark when you think about shadow IT and shadow AI today.
Shadow IT is another term that I really detest. Like, I really detest. And I want to plumb that well a little bit. Shadow IT. This kind of reminds me, in a historical context, of Britain after World War II. Now, here's what I mean by that. So if you've been in the IT function as long as I have, you can remember back to the days when we were the evangelists that kept telling the business functions, IT can change your life. Technology can automate. It can make the whole business run better. And when we weren't looking, they went off and started to spend money to like bring technology into their functions to do what we had told them they should do for years, right? Except that what we didn't tell them is we wanted them to do it only through us. Like, you could only have this technology if you let us be the arbiters. Like, we didn't mean you could go off and do it yourself. So what is that? And in the case of Britain, my analogy there is, you know, poor Britain. The pound was like, you know, what the dollar is, it is today. They were a global superpower. You know, they had a great economy, et cetera. And then they like won the war. And after the war, they said, holy, what happened? You know, like, we lost the colonies. You know, we're still on ration cards like 3 years after the war. I don't understand this. Like, this wasn't supposed to happen like this. So that's the analogy from a historical perspective. So what I think we have to do in IT, and what people have gradually come around to, is we don't own the technology anymore in most, you know, across the board, nor should we. You know, when I was at Okta, I think when I left, we had 600 or 800 SaaS applications. I can't add value for my IT organization for 800 SaaS applications. I mean, I don't. They're applications in marketing and HR and other, you know, that I wouldn't really add any value. So we used to have this ownership paradigm. What we need to come to terms with and actually promote is a stewardship paradigm. We're still the stewards, right? We still need, a CEO can look at us and say, how did you let marketing go off and do that? Like, how did you not enforce like our privacy policy across their systems? Or how did you let them write some form of data into our systems of record that have fouled up, you know, our invoicing capabilities, or, you know, whatever happens? So you need, there are some functions where, I shouldn't say functions, there are activities that can solely be performed by a centralized group, you know, and ideally you should be kind of like the trusted partner. So when they go off and look at something, they should at least stop by and say, I'm looking at this thing, and, you know, what would be the consequences of that? So that's applicable to the AI world that we're going to find ourselves in here as well. I mean, we can't be like the single thread through which every AI related purchase or upgrade or, you know, is introduced into the company. That's not going to happen. But we need to be responsible for defining the risks, putting in place the right safeguards, and helping the functions, you know, think about the trade-offs involved in using different kind of co-pilots and, you know, apps, et cetera, AI-based apps, from both a security and a privacy and cost perspective at the end of the day. I mean, I think, but again, it's a stewardship model. They, you know, there may be some absolute policies around security and privacy where there's a summary judgment that says, no, you can't do that. But if they're going to get into some other situations, they can at least go in maybe forewarned, forearmed by some of the issues that they're likely to encounter at the end of the day. But yeah, this is a very fertile area right now. I'm on calls like every week. There's a couple of calls about new discovery tools to keep track of all the AI apps that are coming into the company or the co-pilot additions with the existing vendors are offering. And then beyond discovery, you know, how to think about, you know, managing some of the risks. In fact, it's a kind of a bit of a throwback to the early days of the CASBs.
Well, Mark, you've just proven out or disproven Plato. Again, I start with the Plato quote. And when he said, the person who dares to tell the truth is called at once a lunatic and a fool. And that is not the case with you. And you've taught us a lot of great truth telling here. And your newsletter, The Modern CIO, is where you do a lot of writing today, a lot of this thought leadership. How do we subscribe to that? Do we just go find it? We can subscribe that way?
Anybody can subscribe, but I suggest just reach out on LinkedIn and I'll send you a recent edition. You can take a look and decide if it's your cup of tea or not.
Excellent. Excellent. And Mark, you've been very kind with your time, but also with our Tech for Good, our scholarship. You know, we've committed over $350,000 to date and donating scholarships to nonprofits. And you were kind of passed the baton to me. So I appreciate that. And I've not had that opportunity before. So I've thought a lot about this. And our good friend Ron Guerrier now is the CIO for Save the Children.
And, oh, yeah. Excellent.
Doing amazing work. And he'll be on the podcast next year. So we'll be catching up with him. But yeah, I know he's got building a really strong IT team, as Ron always does. And so we'll get one of his folks plugged into our 9-month IT leadership development program called TechLX. And so thank you for that, Mark. Great. And congratulations, Ron. So, well, as everyone knows, you know, we're not done yet. We're done with the podcast, but you and I are going to spend some time together working on an article. I've got a number of additional questions for you, Mark. There's just so many layers to unpack, but really appreciate you, all of the brilliance you've shared today, the stories. There's lessons in every one of those stories. And just I want people to go get your books, Truth from the Valley, Truth from the Trenches, really rich, rich books there. I'm going to see you next week in great Nashville. You're home now, so looking forward to that. So thank you so much, Mark. Appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
And everyone, until next time, stay well and continue to be courageous truth tellers, just as Mark is, with your team and your company. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Tech Whispers, inside the playbook of the best digital leaders, a Ouellette and Associates podcast. Keep connected with us by subscribing to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show, as this helps us connect the world's best digital leaders with those who aspire to learn, grow, and thrive in this amazing profession. Thanks for listening. Until next time.